It's crazy, the things that people stick up their asses.
Yeah. What are you reading?
10 craziest things people have stuck up their asses.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 444 for the week of January 19th, 2023. Yeah. I am Uncut Subway Sandwich David T. Cole, and I'm here with Deterrent Cat Toy Sarah D. Bunting.
Why is anything anything?
Just some woman, Tara Ariano.
I'm not a cop, I am just some woman.
And word that's just on the tip of your tongue, Alan Sepinwall.
Fox on the run.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, returning from her break, it is our beloved Sarah D. Bunting. Hello,
welcome back, Sarah.
Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks.
You get one of those.
And our guest, he is the chief TV critic at Rolling Stone. You've heard him with us many times. It is Alan Sepinwall. Welcome back, Alan.
Alan. Guys,
I'm always so happy to be here.
We're thrilled to have you, despite the many roadblocks that were in our way. We made it happen. Touch wood that nothing else goes wrong. We're here to talk about Poker Face, in which Charlie Kale, Natasha Lyonne, is a cocktail waitress at the Frost Casino in Las Vegas, a job that we learned she got after she ended up destroying in a private poker game with the casino's namesake owner, Sterling Frost Sr. He figured out that she had an uncanny ability to tell when someone is lying, which makes her an unbeatable poker player. So after the word spread, because gamblers talk, he hired her as a waitress, and now she likes her life. Among other things, she's made a great friend in Natalie, Dasha Polanco, a housekeeper at the hotel. And now Sterling Frost Jr., who's running the place, he's played by Adrian Brody, has heard about Charlie's ability and wants to use it against a whale gambler who wants to start his own private game. And around the same time, Natalie sees something awful she wishes she hadn't in that very whale's room, and a series of events leads to a big life change for Charlie.
Can I just say the pause between whale and gambler really just sent me on a path where this show was fucking bonkers. There's an actual whale.
It takes
in a casino.
Real
better show. Who's to say?
It takes a real BoJack Horseman turn. No, it doesn't. It is live action. It's created and produced by Rian Johnson of Knives Out and Breaking Bad's Ozymandias fame. 4 episodes dropped on Peacock last week. We had access to a couple more. We will be cool about spoilers. I know Alan watched them all. Dave and I did not. We watched 4. Let's do the Chen check-in. Alan, should our listeners watch Poker Face?
Fuck yeah.
Sarah.
Fuck yeah.
Dave.
Well, first of all, language. Second of all, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. It's fun. And let's get into why, starting with Alan. You did a lot of coverage on this at Rolling Stone, where you are chief TV critic. We will link to all of it. One thing that kept coming up was that when Johnson was pitching it around, feedback that he frequently got was that executives wanted there to be more of a season story arc as opposed to the episodic format that it's taken. What do you feel is the appeal of a show like this?
Well, I mean, that's the appeal to start with, is the idea that, like, he's doing, it's kind of a throwback. It's very modeled on Columbo. Even the font is like the universal, you know, NBC murder mystery, you know, title font, more or less. But like, Jesus, it's someone on television wants to make an actual television show. And in this case, it's a guy who mostly does movies.
Yeah.
And usually when you get that happen, it's like they come here and they're going to make, you know, ooh, it's a 10-hour movie. And it's just this enormous
favorite
bag of plot. And it's just so, such a slog to get through. And this is episodes of television, and each one is almost entirely self-contained. Every now and then Benjamin Bratt will show up, but that's about it.
Yeah.
And so right there, I'm happy, but it's also, it's a really good television show that wants to be a television show. Rian Johnson is a really smart filmmaker, as we've seen, you know, with the Knives Out movies. He loves mysteries. He loves constructing them. And he's got Natasha Lyonne, who is both a force of nature, but not just like doing Russian Doll again. One of the things that's really fun about this is Charlie is outgoing. She's curious. She's warm. She likes the people that she meets.
Mm-hmm.
In some of the mysteries, the problem is suddenly she realizes, oh, this person I befriended is in fact the killer. What, you know, how do I deal with that? So all of that's good. The actors, I was just delighted. I had a big smile on my face from ear to ear with each episode I watched.
I like that it's not just Columbo. It's mostly Columbo, but it's also like a little Highway to Heaven in there. Mm-hmm. And there's just like enough changes from a very familiar format, a very familiar and enjoyable format as somebody who's in the middle of his first Columbo watch right through. Mm-hmm. Thanks mostly to past guests Alan Sepinwall and Will Leach. He's tweaked the formula in just enough, in just the right ways to modernize it without modernizing it.
Yeah.
And I really like that. And once you see Natasha Lyonne in the lead, you're like, well, it can't be anybody else.
Yeah. I'll add about the modernizing thing. I was going to bring this up later, but I need to start tracking like the various ways that movies and TV shows like take smartphones out of the equation. Cause here she has to smash her phone cause she needs to be off the grid so that the bad casino manager, the mean guy who's tracking her, Benjamin Bratt, can't find her. She can't use her ATM card either for the same reason. She uses it once and immediately he's like on her. But I thought that was very clever. That's another way that it feels like a throwback where it's like the problems are not, other than in the first episode where she's reading listicles about butt things, smartphones are like really not part of the equation. Sarah, you are a known Law and Order fan, which is also a, you know, has a serial, has some characters that recur, but is mostly in at least all but the one terrible season I hate. Mm-hmm. Standalone storytelling. What are your feelings about this?
I also enjoyed that. I enjoyed the fact that like the only real notes I took, which is really a note in anything's favor, is that if I'm not constantly scribbling things except for being like, you know, for episode two, like, hey, it's Cliff Clavin dressed like Uncle Jesse. Like, I mean, that was the shit. And it took me a second because he does look different enough. Mm-hmm. Since I'm wrapping up a Cheers rewatch, but that every single person is having an absolute ball, even if they're playing someone who is trying to cover up a murder. These are people who sort of understand what they're a part of and are really enjoying it. And Natasha Lyonne is just absolutely one of a kind and, you know, fascinating. Like your eye absolutely follows her and the characters that she plays, this is distinct from Russian Doll, but the characters that she plays, you could sort of see them thinking and follow it, but not so much that you're ahead of the action and you're bored, which is also a gift of Rian Johnson's work, in my opinion. So this was just super enjoyable and well-built. I would say that this is what our past guest, our esteemed colleague, Linda Holmes, and I would call a Michael Clayton property. Basically, mm-hmm. like it's almost this seamless egg of a thing that you can't really see any joints mm-hmm. On it. It's just perfect as it is. And it's not trying to do everything. It's not trying to do too much. It's just like, this is the story. This is what we're doing. It does it. You're entertained. It's on to the next episode, except occasionally evil Ray Curtis, casino security guy, appears and looms over people mm-hmm. Or elbows someone in the mosh pit, which was delightful also. I mean, it's just like a really confident show that's not smelling its own farts, and that's so rare. So yeah. I loved it, and I'm definitely going to keep watching it. But I feel that the drop schedule is super weird. Can we talk about that?
Oh, what are they doing?
Yeah, it's because it's four is too much to drop at once, in my opinion. Like, yeah. We watched them all, and yes. At the end of it, Dave was like, well, we didn't have to do that. And was like, but they were there. Like, I think a lot of people, based on at least the people on our Discord who were talking about it, it seems like everybody watched at least to the fourth one, because there was a lot of commentary about, like, can't wait to hear what certain panelists has to say about that.
But I feel like for a show like this, I'd rather watch it one a week.
Yeah.
You know, just because they are 89% self-contained episodes with a little bit of now the what's the one armed man up to kind of stuff
right
at the end. Like, I could see dropping two at the start. Mm-hmm. Like, I could really see, like, okay, let's get the premise out there.
Yep.
And then let's seal the deal on what the format of the show by watching two. Then one a week, I would say. Peacock.
Well, I was thinking this about Better Call Saul, because spoiler, I guess, we're considering an episode for the canon in just a few minutes. But I was just thinking about how, like, I'm not smart enough about how TV is made to understand how Gilligan et al. Do this. But Better Call Saul is perfectly built for both episodic enjoyment week to week, and giving you that little bit of like, oh, I can't wait to see what happens next. And also to just keep streaming it like a whole bunch of them in one shot. And that's also kind of rare and interesting to think about why that's true. And I would think that this show, like, I feel like this show is also that. But I just don't understand dropping four at once. I mean, especially since they're like, oh, yeah, we're going to keep doing more seasons of it. Like, well, that's great. But then don't dump all your content now. I just don't think I understand it.
I think Peacock was just so excited to have a show people were talking about. They're like, oh, my God, put it all out.
True.
It may be possible. I mean, I'm not a crackpot, but maybe Peacock doesn't know what it's doing.
Yeah. Ah, what?
Interesting. But it is one a week after this, right? It's not like four every
week. Yeah, it was just the four, and then we'll get six more weeks of it. But also, like, if they'd done two, you would have 9 weeks of this on your service, and you would have more of a reason for people to be on there, more of a reason to people open the app and maybe check out other things you're doing on a service where basically the only original content anyone's watching is the British soccer coverage and not any of the actual scripted shows you're doing, which feels like a problem to me. I don't get it.
Before we move on from the format of it, you know, Dave already mentioned the other forebears for this show. Obviously, Columbo, that's the analogy most people are dropping. But, you know, Dave mentioned Highway to Heaven. It's also, it's a little bit Incredible Hulk. It's a little bit Murder, She Wrote. It's a little bit Quantum Leap, you know.
It's a little bit Knight Rider. I mean, there's a cool car.
Yes. Or, you know, yeah, less of a mystery. But yes, point taken. So, Alan, if the show is a hit, how likely do you think it is that it will inspire a return to episodic storytelling or, you know, copycats?
I mean, God, I can only hope so. But on the other hand, I don't feel like the success of Knives Out necessarily launched a spate of other things like it. I think maybe the business kind of looks at Ryan as a one in one or one of one, where it's like, okay, he can do this. We don't really know how to anymore. And like, we talked a lot more about this subject than what wound up in any of the features, and just the gist of like, he was kind of shocked by how few people in the business seem to even understand what he was trying to do. And everyone's just so conditioned now to do the 10-hour movie thing in the drama space. I mean, I hope so. I would love for it to be a hit, both because I want to see a lot more of this, but also because I want to see a lot more television that's not ashamed to be television in general. But who knows? And again, there's the Peacock problem more than anything else. But there's definitely a lot of buzz for this, and this is just such a good show. And she is, if not like a superstar, I feel like she's enough of a star now that hopefully it's going to bring some people to it.
Yeah. So when only one character has a through line for the entire show, I mean, also Benjamin Bratt, they have to be very winning. What do you think they have specifically gotten right with Charlie as a character? Alan, you already mentioned her curiosity and her just like friendliness, which does seem like, I mean, in a way, it's a departure from her, from Nadia and Russian Doll, but Nadia also had a lot of friends. They were all at her fucking party, so it's hard to say. But anyway,
but you would kind of wonder like why she had so many friends. Whereas with Charlie, it's like you understand how no matter where she goes, she's able to get a job instantly. Mm-hmm. She's able to feel attached enough to the victim that like it matters, even if she's only been there for a few hours or a day or whatever. It's really. The one criticism I would have of the show is compared to Columbo, where the episodes are like 70, 75 minutes, these are an hour at most, and most of them are in the 45-minute range. And so if you do 15 or 20 minutes with just the killers, and then you do another 10 minutes flashing back to what Nadia was up to before the murder, there's Charlie, damn it! Yeah, there's very little time to actually see, like, the meat of the show, which is Nadia hassling the killer. Charlie hassling the killer. Damn, I did it twice. Okay, so very little time to get to the meat of the show. And so in this case, I would like the episodes to be a little bit longer, or maybe we don't need quite so much of what was Charlie doing just off screen in the initial stuff we watched.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it can be in some of the I mean, less successful being like just an A instead of an A+ in this case. But like the second episode is a little stately in the pace. Like, I think they do a great job of scene setting and like rebuilding the new world each time. But that can get a little bit like atmospheres successfully established. It's now minute 22. Mm-hmm. Let's get to the Charlie factory.
Right.
So that could be tightened up a little bit, I guess. But I think that another thing that the show does well is sort of letting the viewer sort of fill in some blanks about what Charlie's life was like before. Like, I certainly hope that once it gets its feet under it, it's not like childhood flashbacks. Like,
right.
Just do what you do. Yeah. But this viewer sort of spent a lot of time thinking about what kind of a person this character is, that the fact that she can tell when people are lying and how often they do it still hasn't turned her into a complete misanthrope.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's out there in the world sort of like taking its hand every day, which definitely sets her apart from Nadia, but also is like pretty unusual for any character of this type in a prestige show, whether it's episodic or serial, that, you know, she absolutely knows the worst of what people get up to, and she's still kind of curious, like we were saying. So that's really well done and a smart way to position her emotionally, I think.
I got to push back on Alan on the Columbo time thing. Because if you take Columbo and you watch Columbo and it is 77 minutes long and you subtract, let's say, the 5-minute segment of him getting a tow truck from a Malibu gas station to check the timing on something, and you turn that into a 30-second modern thing, I think that the plotting is about the same. I'm not complaining about those scenes in Columbo where it's like a weird real-time slice of life because it is very quaint in a retro setting.
Yes.
I don't think that would work quite as well in a modern poker face setting, but I think like plot time on screen is probably very similar between these two shows when you boil it down.
Yeah, like graded on a curve, agree.
In Alan's interview with Rian Johnson, he mentioned specifically, Dave, the segment that was added for to stretch. And it was when Columbo is called up from the audience at the Martin Landau cooking show to like just get a lesson in cooking. It's like Peter Falk is laughing through the whole thing. Yeah. It seems like a rehearsal.
Yeah.
So goofy. But yes, it's very, very winning. Yeah. All right. We've waited long enough. We have to get to episode 4. Sarah.
Oh, I've been waiting for this.
Tell us why all of our listeners were dying for your reaction to our 4th episode.
All right, one sec.
Spoilers ahoy.
The crux of the mystery is the Benson theme, and its status as intellectual property. as strained through the hilarious cheesecloth of a one-hit wonder metal band fronted by Chloe Sevigny.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not the only sort of like, you know, Russian doll cinematic universe person.
Yep.
That we see. I was pretty excited to see Polanco, and then I was like, oh. As soon as I realized what it was, and, you know, here's this like new drummer just like guffawing his head off while watching Benson on an iPad, I was like, okay, Twitter. I just like went into my mentions and was like, not to worry. I will be talking about this on Extra Hot Podcast. I thought it was very, very clever. And I think that was also the episode where there was a D.B. Cooper reference.
Yep.
But I could be confusing that with the Better Call Saul that we're talking about later. So good times. Yeah, I mean, I loved it. Perfectly done. And as with all the other things in this universe, like, it's clever, but it doesn't stand back and be like, eh? Like, it just does what it does. So,
yeah,
that was a lot of fun. And I've had both versions of the song stuck in my head now for 3 days. I don't hate it. I'm not mad.
I was surprised that they decided to bring in a show that is not streaming on Peacock. It's on Amazon Prime. It has recently been added, Benson, but you know they could have done a pretty great metal cover of the Murder, She Wrote theme song.
That reminds me, we need to track down and watch for the show the Benson UFO episode.
Yes,
sometime. Just putting that out there in the universe again
for sure.
This also reminds me that I think I owe you guys a sequel to the Is This Benson Game Time that I wrote for you like 4 years ago.
Yes, please. All right, we already brought up Chloe Sevigny, and certainly after Glass Onion, Rian Johnson's Knives Out follow-up came to Netflix in December, people were talking about who are the actors you want to see in the next Knives Out movie, you know, because it's the ensemble is a huge part of what makes them so winning. And obviously, this is a guy that actors love to work with. Who were some of the guest stars that stood out? We've mentioned Chloe Sevigny. Who else? Alan, who were your standouts?
Oh, God, I'm trying to remember which were the episodes here. I mean, I really liked Adrian Brody, and what I liked about... What I liked about that is she's got this human lie detector power, but not every episode leans on it. Some of it, it barely comes up at all. But with that one, it's specifically she has told him about it before she realizes he's a murderer, and so he can use it against her. And so you're just watching Adrian Brody for the second half of the episode thinking, I cannot tell a lie here. So I'm going to phrase everything as a question. And like, he's a good actor to just watch think. That was really a lot of fun.
Yep. Sarah, who else, who stood out for you?
Shout out to the voice of Sterling Frost Sr., Mr. Ron Perlman. Love it. Perfect. Cliff Clavin, just taking his hearing aid out when someone, he doesn't want to hear them talking, which nice hat tip to actual Cliff Clavin. That's John Ratzenberger. I'm not an idiot. I know they're not the same person. I also enjoyed Emily Yoshida's The Murder Girl podcast. Amazing. It's just so, and the touch with that was just right, too, because it's like these people all live in the media world and they're not trying to step on the hem of Only Murders in the Building's pant legs. So they're just like, all right, we're going to do this. It's going to be, and she's like, I solve murders. And then they just cut away to the next thing when Charlie's like, huh, okay. Like, I just, I love that. I love that we're now at the part in the culture's sort of echo chamber where you know where to stop leaning on that particular quote satire, which is a parody of itself at this point. So that was very enjoyable. I thought the dog was perfectly handled. Yes. Like when a dog has been attempted murdered, it's like, oh boy, you better not fuck this up.
Yep.
And then everything spoiler
the wound MAGA up. Okay. Dog. Yes. Hated the MAGA dog.
Well, Jack Russells are tough, you know.
But I mean, to get back to Emily Yoshida, one of the things I like is it's like the Knives Out movies. It's very much a use every part of the Buffalo show. Mm-hmm, so you keep thinking, oh, this is just a funny little bit.
Nope.
No, it always comes back. And as a plot point, the guy at the garbage can in the subway episode, he proves valuable to solving the murder. Murder Girl turns out to be good because a lot of the time they have to do things where it's like, she's not a cop. She's a fugitive. She can't stick around to make sure these people get arrested.
Yep.
But somehow she's able to make it work.
Dave, was there any standouts for you in the guest cast?
Well, I mean, the dog is my worst. I think everybody covered it. I kind of like a little Rel in the in the barbecue episode.
Yep.
I feel like we haven't really seen him, you know, play the real true dick in that particular way. In that episode, the fact that the reason the guy goes vegan is because he watches a particular movie.
Yeah.
And instantly he stops cooking meat, which is like... Like, those are the touches that separate it from what came before. Like, it is a little absurdist in ways that, I mean, not that Columbo is still in a reality, whereas this one, like, it plays with it a bit with those kind of, like, crazy things, which keeps it, you know, keeps you on your toes, and I enjoy that part of it.
And there's a whole episode out of order, I think, where we find out why she had all these DVDs in the back of her car. Like, I got the feeling that it wasn't just to watch them, but perhaps she was selling them.
Right,
and then
that's
going to be a whole other episode that gets slotted in at some point. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's just so good and like uncomplicatedly good, but...
I do have, what do you guys think about the superpower though? Like, was that necessary for the show? Like, if there's one thing I could say, like, I wasn't crazy about, it was like the TV version of the Lion Cat from the saga comic book, where it just exists to say lying. I wonder if they could have wrote around that and if that's not just like a shortcut to a lot of things for them.
Yeah, well, that was another thing that came up in Alan's interview with Rian Johnson, which is I'd totally forgotten until I read it that's also like the opposite is a plot point in Knives Out, the original movie, that the Ana de Armas character can't lie. So I think it's interesting as like there it was more of an impediment. Here it's more like, how do we write around this so that the we see, like Alan said about the Adrian Brody character, so we see them, you know, figuring out how to deal with her. But also, like, if she didn't have this, she wouldn't necessarily get embroiled in all these situations. I mean, I hope at a later episode, at some point, she's like, it's weird that everywhere I go, someone gets murdered, because it is. I mean, I know this was the murder she wrote problem, too. But I do think it's interesting as a writing problem to show how they, how the murderers get around it and how she, like, asks the right questions to get them to incriminate themselves.
I will say the fact that she is on the lam is fun because it is also like a little bit of a travelogue series too. And unlike Columbo, let's say, where everything is in LA for the most part, except for that one where he goes to England for some reason.
That was so weird.
it's, you know, it's like the Indiana Jones map, you know, like every we're moving along and we get all these little road points. I enjoyed that part of it too.
Yeah. Agree. Well, it's nice when we all like a show. It doesn't happen that much lately.
Yeah.
Good job, January. Way to get on the map and a way to close out in a good way.
All right. It's time to go around the dial. The first stop is Tara.
Cracking my knuckles because it's time for Married at First Sight again. It is season 16. It started just weeks after season 15 ended because they are not fucking around with this franchise. We are now in Nashville. There were 4 hours of preseason programming. Then it took three 2-hour episodes just to get all of the couples married because 5 couples is too many. But that said, my classic early season impressions of the couples. Here we go. Everyone who doesn't care about the show, fast forward. Eris and Jasmine, his designation as a groom is reformed player, even though the only evidence that he is reformed is that he has applied for this show and told the experts that he is. However, when he's hanging out with the other grooms for the first time before the weddings, he says he hooked up with a woman as recently as a couple of weeks ago who he met on an app. So that's while he was actively in the casting process. After the wedding, Jasmine asks his thoughts on dogs. And I'm just going to say the experts should have known better than to match someone who, like Eris, says he is fine with dogs. Mm. And someone who, like Jasmine, has 4 of her own dogs plus 9 puppies because she breeds dogs. Strike one against her as a person. So there's that. Another is he works days. She is a cheerleading coach. She works nights. The main issue for these two, though, is that Eris is pretty clearly only signed up for this out of duty because he's an only child and on some level he wants to give his mother grandchildren, but he just seems to me like he does not want to stop fucking around, so watch this space. Next, McKinley and Dominique. Oh boy, he mysteriously happened to move to Nashville just in time for casting. He like does not have an address. He's living with a friend's parents. His mother is extremely opposed to him doing the show and offered him $50,000 before the wedding to not do it, which he didn't take.
Oh, I was hoping that was the con.
Dominique is the youngest bride at age 25. Her mother signed her up for the show. And by Dominique's own description, she has only had a couple of serious relationships before. The last one ended 3 years ago, so when she was 22. Maximum. She is too young for this. He is one of the blandest men the show has ever cast. For that reason, it might work out. I would say otherwise his mom might be an issue, but she lives in Michigan, so it's not like she's going to be around disapproving at them. Shaquille and Kirsten. On him, I'm going to say he makes his own bow ties. I feel like that's all I need to say. Not to imply he's closeted, just he's weird. So, Kirsten. Her father will not be participating in the show because he refused to get COVID tested. Not even vaccinated, just tested. So she comes from stupid. She gives Shaquille her cheek at the altar because he didn't ask to kiss her, and she is secretly testing him for the whole wedding day, waiting to see if he will ask. He finally does the next day, and then she still won't kiss him, so I don't know what this test is about. He does not help himself by making them miss the start of their honeymoons because he is in a PhD program and he has to present a paper at a conference in Jackson, Mississippi, and she has to go with him so they can leave from there together. And then she films herself whining about being stuck in the hotel room while he does conference stuff. I get that Jackson's not Jamaica. I'm sure there are things to do in a city of 150,000 people. Only boring people are bored. He seems fine. She already doesn't like him, so this isn't going to work. Chris and Nicole. I hate to give my honest opinion on her, because in the latest episode, she tells Chris about a past abusive boyfriend who burned her with cigarettes. Yikes. That should drive a person into therapy and not a dating show, in my opinion. That said, every season they get the bride and groom's loved ones to describe them for the ceremony. And even for that, her family and friends were like, she's a lot. And she is. Meanwhile, Chris is so recessive. His loved ones tell Nicole at brunch he never breaks up with anyone, even if he's having a horrible time in the relationship. So it's going to be on her to end things if that happens, which is a lot to put on someone who met Chris yesterday. I can't tell if they're going to work. Purely because she bulldozes him with her manic energy and crazy eyes, chances are decent. Finally, Clint and Gina. His personality has a sailboat. And in case you ever forget, he talks in sailing metaphors constantly, but at the same time, they're like entry-level sailing metaphors. So the much that you wonder, does he have a sailboat or is he trying to seem like someone who has a sailboat? On the wedding night, we see him with his shirt off. It looks like he shaves his chest hair, but like just so it won't show when he's wearing a deep V-neck shirt, which is weird. Gina has the second craziest eyes of the season. She and Clint seem to get along at first, but in two non-consecutive teases from the episode that is airing tonight as you listen to this, it looks like she tells him she is not into redheads, which he is. And he says she's too fat for him, so I'm not sure that they make it back to Nashville married. And that's Married at First Sight season 16. Early impressions. Sorry, Dave, that that was so long. For my plug, this is going to tie into Alan's next thing, but I wrote about what therapists and pop culture you might want to see if shrinking has you thinking about pop culture therapists, and that's at vanityfair.com. We'll link it in the show notes.
All right, Alan, what do you have for us?
First, before I get to that, I just remember regarding shrinks, when I told my therapist about the premise of The Patient, the Steve Carell FX show, he's like, oh, that sounds so funny. And I said, it's not a comedy.
Debatable.
All right.
I mean, I laughed a lot.
Okay, so I want to talk about Shrinking, which debuted last week on Apple TV+. It's the new show kind of from the Ted Lasso guys, specifically Bill Lawrence and Brett Goldstein, and co-created by Jason Segel, who stars. It's, stop me if you've heard this one before, it's a doctor who's more messed up than his patients. In this case, yes, he's a widower. He's been in a spiral for about a year since his wife died in a car accident, you know, doing coke, just like abandoning his daughter, more or less, all of these things. And they're trying to pull him out. And he works with Jessica Williams and Harrison Ford, who, by the way, is a goddamn delight. I'm so happy to see Harrison Ford like in kind of working girl mode again. The only two episodes have dropped so far on Apple, and they're not two of the better ones. It's this Bill Lawrence show problem where it's like, sort of like Cougar Town, where the actual premise is not very good, and it takes them like 3, 4, 5 episodes to just let it evolve into, here's a bunch of funny people, let them be funny together. And at that point, I really, really got into it, and it's kind of sweet, too. And there's a few moments where I genuinely got choked up, again, mostly involving Harrison Ford. But yeah, so if you like sort of the Lawrence, you know, Lasso, Segel, overly emotional, kind of silly, kind of, you know, sappy thing, but you were not crazy about the episodes that dropped last week, I would say try to be patient if you can, but I know there's a lot of TV out there. And for my plug, I recently, in the midst when it seemed like Twitter was about to vanish any second, I started my own Substack newsletter. It's free. It's primarily just an easy way to, you know, see links and a little bit of discussion of what I've written every week for Rolling Stone. But also at the moment, relevant to this episode, I am doing like weekly recaplets of every episode of Poker Face, because I feel like, you know, I talked with my editors and we really couldn't justify giving it the full schmear on RollingStone.com itself. But I also want to celebrate the fact that, like, here's an episodic show that needs to be discussed in the way I always used to discuss things back on the original What's Alan Watching blog. And so I'm going to do it in the What's Alan Watching newsletter. And it's just alanseppenwald.substack.com.
Yay!
If you ever need a new title for that, for whatever legal reason, I would like to propose, try to be patient. There's a lot of TV out there.
Yup.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Welcome to Extra Hot Leon. I don't know why I didn't get around to the second season of Russian Doll until last week. I adored the first season. I think maybe the issue was that I wanted to rewatch the first season first before digging into the outing from 2022. And I didn't feel like I had the time to do the whole thing, because if I recalled correctly, it was going to be one of those things where I was just in for like 4 hours and could not be moved even to pee. But in any case, I finally did the rewatch slash watch the second season. And I remember at the time when Tara talked about it on EHG that she described it as quite moving when she talked about it. And it really is. And I was struggling to articulate why without sort of rambling around the subject for an hour. I will do my best. Part of it, I think, is the quality Russian Doll has of successfully replicating, quote, mission-oriented anxiety dreams. You're trying to get across a big party or return an item and you just can't quite get it done. I just had one of these last night involving hotel keys and a broken escalator. I don't know. I mean, I do know it's never that deep. Anyway, without getting bogged down in the parts of the dreams that make them tiresome to everyone, but the dreamer is one of Russian Doll's many gifts. And it has a wit to it and the suggestion of time's elasticity, but it doesn't go too heavy on the surreal symbology or dwell on shots to make sure that you appreciate the show's own cleverness. That same light touch is in evidence in its treatment, so to speak, of Nadia's mother, Nora, as well as in the second season's trips back to early 80s New York, early 60s East Berlin, and particularly 1944 in Eastern Europe. Scripted narratives, ideas about hallucinatory mental illnesses are so often just a bag of twitchy shortcuts and unsure direction. And then you add to that time travel to periods that are already so fraught that Russian Doll understands it doesn't have to and shouldn't do too much, so it does exactly what it needs to without getting in your ear all, whoa, whoa. And particularly in the second season finale, that last shot in which it's unclear if Nadia is close to laughing or crying, I kept thinking back to the idea that sleep and dreams are where we can meet again with our dead. And what an elegant trick Russian Doll pulls off, making these mythic ideas of ghosts and the fourth dimension and dreams manageable and human scale in the form of Natasha Lyonne. It's just really good and simple, elegant, bittersweetness that it looks extremely easy the way the show does it, but is extraordinarily difficult. And when it ended, I just sat there and thought about it and mourned the end of it and celebrated its existence. So it's just really good. It's a good show.
Yeah, I think you might have waited to get to it because the second season didn't get super great reviews. I think I liked it more than most people did. And part of that I suspected at the time and still think kind of is that because I did rewatch all of season one first before I watched season two for my review. And when you do that, you can see how much teeny tiny stuff you didn't really notice in season one comes up and pays off in season two. Like it's so intricately constructed that I think you can't really appreciate that because there's so much stuff you would have forgotten from season one because it just seemed like a throwaway detail, but it's not. And I agree with you about the end. And you know, when you said you already spoiled it sort of, I mean, this is almost a year old now, but the episode that ends with her waking up in Eastern Europe, that was when I like burst into tears like spontaneously. It's so good. The ending is absolutely lovely. Great work from Elizabeth Ashley in particular in season two, and you understand so much more about their relationship. So yeah, if you were waiting to watch it, to give it a shot. It's really special.
Yeah, it is. And there was that moment. The moment where I lost it was when Charlie Barnett's character Alan comes upon, I guess, his grandmother in the void subway station. And he's just like, I just don't understand any of this. And like what she says to him is just so simple and beautiful. Like it's something to the effect of like, we don't really understand it either. We're just here. And, you know, like just accepting where you are and when you are in any given time. Mm-hmm. You know, the writing of this could so easily just flop into just like sweaty, overwrought, you know, opera on the soundtrack, but it never does that. And it's a very narrow, high up tightrope. And as someone who, you know, has missed the last couple of weeks because she was dealing with a death in the family, this was really speaking to me. And mm-hmm. I was very sensitive to what it was doing and extremely impressed and gratified by it. But I think you're right. I think it didn't get great reviews or wasn't enough, like, you know, season one, more of that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think people didn't quite know what to do with this gear.
Yeah,
of the show, but watch it is what you should do. For my plugs, speaking of Elizabeth Ashley, aka Ruth, she wrote a very frank memoir back in the day. It's called Actress, Postcards from the Road. And if you can put hands to a copy, you should. It's usually like $5 on eBay. It is really something and a fast read. I recommend it. Second, Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs is going back in time to try to determine which Record of the Year Grammy winner is the best of all time, or more accurately, the least bafflingly safe, corny, and unconsciously biased. We are still in the thorny underbrush of the round of 64 at the moment, so come on by. We are wherever you get podcasts and at patreon.com/mastass if you want to vote and be a part of the Grammocratic process.
All right, we've been talking for a while, so I'm going to very quickly dispense with Lockwood and Company on Netflix. This is like a YA Ghostbusters, but it's very boring. Like, the whole thing is told over afternoon sandwiches and tea. I think that's all you need to know. Netflix, I'm not a crackpot. Netflix's lane should be fun mid-movies.
Yeah.
Disposable reality shows.
Yes.
And then premium TV.
Mm-hmm.
Like, back when they first started. Like, get back to the... you know, the House of Cards days where it was actually like, oh shit, it's a new HBO.
Totally. I would never have checked this out if not for the fact that it's from the Attack the Block guy. But like, yeah, after 5 episodes of 8, I was like, I think I'm good on this.
Well, the Attack the Block was infused with such sort of kinetic energy
mm-hmm.
and mayhem. And this one is like they got a bunch of teens to play old Victorian grandpas. And that yes. is how it all plays out. It's just like everybody's sleeping through the whole thing. That's all we need to say about it.
Yes. Sarah, you might like it, though. Go on, Dave. No, I mean, because it's like, it's ghosty and it's
because
process-y.
We have to make time for...
The stars at night, a big and bright.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
Like, I swore off 911 Lone Star because it wasn't just exciting anymore. It wasn't bonkers enough. But they came back, and it's bonkers again. Let me walk you through the cold open. So the cold open... involves some don't think about it too hard freak weather system
mm-hmm.
that's coming to the area.
Yep.
It superheats a midway show.
Mm-hmm.
The highlight is when a guy runs away from his girlfriend to urgently use the porta potty because mm-hmm. he had some dodgy carnival food.
He had fried soup.
Fried soup, that's right. The storm hits, melts the door of the porta potty, then picks up the porta potty, flings it into the air
yep.
higher than the Ferris wheel. Before landing in water and slowly sinking, and that's this guy's, like, frantic call to 911.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, we learn, after searching nearby ponds and sources of water, we learn that the whole porta-potty has managed to land in the dunk tank
yep.
of the Midway.
At the carnival.
Now, how does the heat that melts plastic and makes the metal of a Ferris wheel a one-second contact burn not also cook people? Well, that's a story for another day. And speaking of the stories for another day, Rob Lowe's character, you know, the super savvy one that kind of knows something about everything. He's sort of like the Gorin of Lone Star. He's gotten into motorcycles in the off season in a big way. Mm. And he's joined some like-minded blokes who mm-hmm. also like to ride. But as he finds out, also like to brand Nazi symbols into arms.
Whoops.
And save America from itself.
Yep.
So he's like, well, I'm out of here. But then the FBI's like, not so fast. Don't sell that motorcycle. You're going undercover.
That's
what I like about Texas.
The only problem is this fucking show, it moved to Tuesday. So now if we like continue to talk about it, we're going to be a week behind. But I'm not saying that's a reason to not do it because I still love the show.
Set your DVRs. Watch it after with the report.
That's right.
So I got to see where this stupid storyline is going. All right. Coming up on the next Extra Extra Hot Great, it is Latter-day Subways. Remember Chuck and Subway? What shows could benefit from that same relationship? And then right here on EHG Prime next week, we welcome back to the Blankenship Chair, Mr. Mark Blankenship, to talk about Dear Edward. yes, quiet.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
I am not a crackpot. So-called bottle episodes are way overpraised. For starters, you're all using this term wrong. A bottle episode was traditionally known as an episode of a series that used only existing sets and main characters to save money during a season, allowing a budget reset for more expensive episodes. A classic example of this is Friends, the one where no one's ready, where just the six friends spend the whole episode in Monica's apartment. This definition has been altered and expanded in the past decade to apply to any episode that sits outside of the main plotting and momentum of the season. One of the first of these I remember gaining wide acclaim is One Man's Trash from season two of Girls, where Hannah has a tryst with an older doctor. This uses only one character from the main cast, along with a guest star and a one-off location. So much for the savings. I mean, it's obvious why these episodes stand out over more standard ones. They're simply more unique and memorable. They're great awards bait. They can show you familiar characters out of their comfort zones. But I think that all that praise is way overblown. To my mind, these are just not episodes of a TV show. They are short films starring the characters of a series. An episode of a series should address all of its main characters, push the story arcs forward, and pull it all together into a satisfying whole that feels a piece as itself and still is a part of a larger whole. I could never write any sort of TV show, but that seems hard. Harder than writing a completely self-contained short film with well-established characters. So instead of hyping the Pierce episode of a season, yes, I went there, why don't we praise the episodes of TV that add depth and understanding to characters, maybe even deviate from the norm, while also serving as a vital and necessary component of a larger narrative. That's what separates us from the animals, meaning TV from movies. Standalone episodes, overrated. I am not a crackpot.
Wow, Jeff. Okay.
Shots fired.
I added this 2-hour rundown before the latest episode of The Last of Us called Long, Long Time dropped. And in response to a bunch of different people calling that a bottle episode, past and future guest Catherine Van Arendonk wrote a post at Vulture where she sort of went off on like, it's not a bottle episode. Stop calling it this. So she proposed, and standalone doesn't quite work either for what Jeff is describing as like the incorrect version of bottle episode. She suggests departure episode and you know, kind of cheekily added, it's just, you know, nice that The Leftovers was exceptionally good at departure episodes, which is true. But Alan, I wanted us to discuss this when you were here. So what do you think of Jeff's claim? Is he a crackpot?
He's definitely not a crackpot about people using the term wrong, and I'm glad Catherine is out there kind of fighting the good fight about that. And I think departure episodes apparently is actually a term that some TV writers use in the business, so
okay.
I'm hoping that that catches on. But I might disagree a little bit in that I do think that there are some, you know, quote-unquote bottle episodes or departure episodes or whatever that, while they break the format, do also have, like, some significant, like, either plot or especially character stuff. So, you know, speaking of Rian Johnson in Breaking Bad, he directed the episode Fly, where they're just chasing the bug around the super lab for an hour. And I know a lot of people hate that because they're like, well, nothing happens in terms of the larger story. What happens is Walt comes like 5 seconds away from confessing to Jesse, oh, I let your girlfriend die. And in fact, I kind of forced her into the position where she choked to death. Like, that's significant. That brings back a thing that hadn't come up in a while, and it sets up a payoff in the next episode, or the last episode Johnson directed, where he actually tells him, like, that's a huge thing, and I do feel like that, and just Walt in general talking about, like, when I'm supposed to die, when would be the ideal moment for that, like, that's a great character moment. I thought about that a lot in later episodes of the series. So I think there is a way to do both, and obviously, I'm as guilty of this as anybody, because when I put together my best episodes list for 2022, I would say, like, 90% of them were episodes like this, like the Claire Danes episode of Fleischman is in Trouble. And there's only a handful that are just, here's a really good regular episode of a show. And mm-hmm. so sometimes, like, I fall as guilty to this as everybody else. But I do think that when you do them really, really well, these departure episodes can be just fantastic and can also feel like television.
Yeah, I mean, prestige TV has so many examples of this being good. I mean, I know we're sort of like past, you know, what we would say, the good old days of AMC and all that, you know, like Mad Men with like Don Draper's past before he was Don Draper, that episode. Like, there's a lot of character building episodes that, okay, they're not involving everybody on the show. That's the part that is crackbody to me. Like, there is no reason a departure episode can't be a worthy piece of television or elevate the show to something else. Like, taking The Last of Us as an example, you have a show about shooting zombies, and then in episode 3, you have this departure episode that is a very sort of thoughtful episode about surviving the apocalypse alone or not. And that was sort of changed the way people perceived the show outside of the whole video game thing. And there are just tons and tons of examples. And some of them are terrible. I agree. Like, some of them are fucking, let's do a claymation episode or whatever, like this gimmicky shit that I hate. But a lot of them are real valuable character studies. And that's usually what they are when they succeed. So, yeah, you know, rail against how people are misusing the term. That's fine. But don't throw the concept under the bus because people are misusing it.
Sarah, what are your thoughts?
I definitely agree that it's instructive to course correct on what we call these episodes and to distinguish between the sort of original meaning of bottle episodes. And like, I know nobody wants to use this term because Silicon Valley ruined it like it did so many other things. But like, disruptor episodes is right there. Format breakers. Like, we can find a term for this as a culture. But I also think that it's just like, not confirmation bias exactly, but like memorability bias, that it might not even be that they're overpraised, but it's like Alan was just saying, like, when it's time to think of, you know, particularly memorable episodes, you're going to remember the ones that were out of format. Like, there's sort of a reason that I pitched that Cheers for the Cannon where everyone's having a food fight in Carla's dining room. Like, they're not in the bar. It's one of like a handful of episodes where they're just not in the bar at all. Is that a bottle episode? No. Is it particularly format disrupting? No. It's actually fairly typical of what Cheers did well when it was doing its best work. But I mean, I think he's not exactly a crackpot. He's just like maybe a little too mad about a minor issue, namely that bottle episodes get disproportionate amounts of attention. But I don't know if it's overpraise. I think it's just like, if you got to come up with the 5 best episodes of whatever show that had 270 of them, you're going to go with a departure episode or whatever
a good company
we agree to call it.
That was the name of our podcast originally. A little too mad.
Yeah, so. I'm not gonna ding anyone for that. I've certainly have been known to get too mad about things, and I think, you know, memorability bias is definitely at play here, as well as like, if you already think that they're overpraised, anytime someone praises them at all, you're going to be like, duh, this again. And I get that.
Yeah,
and you know, everyone on Twitter is in their same bubbles, and so you see things come up, and like, you notice, you're going to notice things that don't jibe with your view more so than you are the opposite. And you know, I think they're appropriately praised. I don't think he's a crap. I don't think this is as big a problem as we think. I do agree with Sarah that like they're more memorable when they break a format, because for obvious reasons. And I also think that it's interesting when a show that does a true bottle episode can like make it compelling. I mean, that Friends one is memorable for a reason. That's like a lot of people's favorite episodes, and it's very good. Like, it does what it's supposed to do brilliantly. And, you know, Catherine in her post mentions other, you know, departure episodes like every fucking season when they do it on Mythic Quest. And like, that's one where I'm like, way too mad, because people are always like, that was the greatest. I'm like, that was jerk off motion for 32 minutes. Like, those are my least favorite episodes ever. And I will say, like, I kind of thought this latest episode of Mythic Quest was quite bad, like enough that I'm probably not going to watch the show anymore. And those episodes to me just seem like smelling their own farts, to use Sarah's example, is like, that's what that is. And they don't feel like they are revealing character to me enough that it justifies it. So not a crackpot, but not a crackpot is my middle of the road ruling.
Schrodinger's crackpot. Yes. Got it.
It is time for the extra hot, great canon user submission this week. Let's hear it.
Today, I'd like to convince you to induct Season 4, Episode 7 of Better Call Saul, titled Something Stupid, into the Extra Hot Great Canon. I believe this episode is canon-worthy because it delivers on every promise the show made when we first heard it was being made. When I tuned into Season 1, Episode 1 of Better Call Saul, I expected to see how an ambulance-chasing lawyer got pulled into a cartel. I should have known that Vince Gilligan would not follow such a direct and short path. We followed Jimmy through various cons, the mailroom at his brother's law firm, and starting his own practice. In this episode, we see Jimmy, unable to practice law, in the next logical career choice, selling burner phones out of a van parked under a bridge while wearing tracksuits. With every purchase, the customer is given a card with a familiar call to action: call Saul. We are watching Jimmy transform to Saul, just as he is watching the transformation of his hairline. We know what's coming in both cases, making both very satisfying. Another promise kept is mesmerizing scenes with camera work and music that takes anything and makes it beautiful to watch. In Breaking Bad, it could be a meth cook, it could be money counting, and in this episode, it's the building of the underground meth lab, with Burl Ives singing Big Rock Candy Mountain. It's gorgeous to watch. And who doesn't love a song that references the dream of cigarettes growing on trees? And again, we know what the future brings for this space, and so it is very satisfying. Another promise delivered on is efficiency in storytelling without endless exposition. I have to pause for a moment here to acknowledge that all or some of this next part may have been put into my brain by Tara. I went back to old Extra Hot Great episodes around the episode's original air date of September 17th, 2015. And I couldn't find an around the dial that referenced Better Call Saul, but out of an abundance of caution, I want to cite an influence, if not a source, on this next part. The opening of this episode is amazing. The entire time, it's a split screen between Kim and Jimmy. They're going through daily life, teeth brushing, breakfast, work. They begin perfectly in sync, almost like a dance. As Kim starts a new job and takes on pro bono cases, Jimmy sells those burner phones. Over time, they fall out of rhythm, become separate, and eventually end up back to back. Here, the storytelling is elegant. It shows that distance in relationships is often not caused by a loud dramatic fight, but quietly and across everyday activities without even being noticed. At the end, Kim's side of the screen goes black, and my stomach drops. We know Kim is not a part of the Breaking Bad universe. So this entire time, we've been waiting for the other shoe to drop and for something bad to happen to Kim. But it's Season 4, it's Episode 7. We've started to relax. And here, we're reminded, in this universe, we can never relax. Now, on to my favorite part of this episode: Gustavo Fring and Hector Salamanca. We see a doctor working with Hector, who is post-stroke, on regaining his ability to communicate. We see he is learning to do this via finger taps. We mentally insert a bell under that finger, and we feel satisfied that we know the origin story of how he communicates. No, we're not done. So we come to find out that Fring is paying for this position, which is really odd because he's the reason why Hector is in this condition. Gus is talking to the doctor, learning about his progress, and he really wants to know, is Hector still Hector? Is he still the same person, or is he lost and gone? While watching a video, Gus watches Hector knock over water just to see the nurse bend over and pick it up. And with this small movement, this small action, Gus knows that this is still Hector. He's trapped in a body that can barely move or barely communicate, but Hector is still Hector. Now, clip four details what comes next.
I've kept you from your work long enough.
Oh.
It is time to delegate Mr. Salamanca's care. His recovery has been remarkable. And my gratitude to you is beyond words.
Are you sure? Hector's progress is very promising. With sustained intensive care, he may eventually learn how to talk and even walk again.
Perhaps we should temper our expectations.
To me, this solidifies Gus Fring as the most evil TV villain of all time. We know the future for Hector. We know it doesn't get better. Knowing the future makes watching this so satisfying. I will now temper my expectations as the Extra Hot Great panel decides the future of Something Stupid, the seventh episode of season four of Better Call Saul.
Thank you, Laura. Alan, you chose this from our submissions. Please start us off.
Well, I find it really interesting the way Laura chose to approach this, because when I saw the episode, you know, as an option, I thought, wow, the one episode of Better Call Saul right now that's in the canon is Chicanery, which is one of the few that has nothing of the cartel whatsoever. And this is an episode that, while it has cartel stuff in it, I think of entirely as a Jimmy Kim episode, not just because of that incredible opening montage, but because so many of my favorite moments in it are Kim sort of slowly starting to recognize, wait a minute, who is this guy who I have sort of thrown my whole life in with? When she finds out, you know, when he tells her about the burner phone stuff in Huel, and then when she's in with, I forget the name of the prosecutor, Suzanne Erickson, and is calling Jimmy a scumbag, and just the look on Ray Seahorn's face as she's doing that. Like, I think all of that stuff is wonderful. I think the montage is maybe the best one they ever did. And this is a show that just did incredible, incredible montages over and over again. I think that the cartel stuff in this episode is very good. I think that the Gus sort of deciding to leave Hector a prisoner in his body thing is excellent. But I never really cared about the, you know, origin of the super lab storyline, even though there's some good moments in it and hearing Big Rock Candy Mountain is fun. But to me, like, this episode is entirely, you know, Jimmy and Kim. And for that reason alone, I would probably be inclined to vote for it just because, you know, Bob and Ray, as always, are fantastic.
Sarah, you were the one who wrote about this episode for our RIP, previously.tv, our old website. Go ahead. You go next.
And I unearthed the recap file because I thought, like, the split screen came up and I was like, oh, it's this one. And then in that way that you recognize the thing that you've recapped that is sort of sui generis, that mm-hmm. you just feel it like, let me inspect my DNA for information about this episode that I have now seen 12 seconds at a time, like four times. I think I also read this recap as an audio file.
You did.
The split screen, despite having already literally nitpicked this entire sequence, it's still extremely effective. And you still, even though now you know what happens, you still have that that sinking feeling as the two sides of the screens begin to fall out of phase over the course of 6 to 8 months. And that, like, just concern and bracing for something to happen to Kim, which, if people within the sound of my voice still don't know the outcome, I'll just move on from that. I think that some of the cartel stuff could be a little fart sniffy, but that was not the case here. I thought it was effective. As I said in my recap, I still want to try whatever Gus was cooking. I feel like there was probably sausage in there, which made it not a Bunsy forward situation, but it just looked delicious, whatever embrudo thing was happening there. And of course, you know, the real bunt nip, Huel decking an undercover cop or a plainclothes cop with a bag of sandwiches, RIP the sandwiches, and then threatening to lam it and be like, well, they didn't get D.B. Cooper. It's like, okay, Huel, couple of notes on this comp, but, you know, any reference in a storm.
Sure.
With that said, I enjoyed watching the episode. I wanted to keep going with it, which is often a hallmark of a successful canon pitch, but usually that's more if it's a show that I haven't seen and I'm not familiar with. And in this case, I wanted to keep going because I couldn't remember exactly the play with the office supplies at the end, and you don't get the actual play at the end. And I think whether we vote for it or against it is going to come down to how important we need it to be that this episode is self-contained, or whether it's more being pitched as an emblematic episode. And even in that regard, I'm not entirely sure that this is the peak. Going back to what Alan said, like, I went back also to check and see what other episodes were in the canon, and was, you know, not shocked that Chicanery was in there, but a little shocked that we hadn't hoisted any others over the transom. That seems like an oversight. But I'm not entirely sure that this one, this was an outstanding show. This is one of my favorite five shows of all time, I think. I think that this episode, I don't want to use the phrase run of the mill, but I think while it is an exemplar, I'm not sure it's like peak. But I'd like to hear what everyone else has to say. I certainly didn't not enjoy revisiting it, but I'm just not sure that you get enough closure from this episode on its own to underline what it's supposed to be emblematic of.
Yeah, I agree. That, and to me, that's like, it feels like it ends in the middle. You already said, yeah, we see the setup, we don't see what the play is. That pays off in the next episode. And I agree with Alan that the best stuff in this episode is the Kim Jimmy stuff. I mean, the scene where they're at a party at Kim's firm.
Oh,
we've just seen in the montage.
So cringy.
Which Laura didn't even bring up. Like, they're at this party. We've just finished seeing in the opening montage, like, part of what Kim has been doing for all this time is like collecting these Lucite, I mean, challenge coin horse statues. So many of them opening Mesa Verde branches that they're like stacked three deep on her shelves by the time the party happens. And so, you know, Jamie is nervous going to this thing. She's like, just be yourself. She's like, Kim, they've already sort of, you know, we've seen them kind of drifting apart in that cold open. And then at the party, he just puts her boss, Rick Schweikert, on blast for, like, you know, they're talking about this retreat that they're going to take for the firm. And he's like, why not this ski place? Why not this nicer ski place? And Rick's like, I don't know, maybe. And then Jimmy, like, because he's Jimmy, keeps talking and being like, fly everyone to Aspen in a chartered private jet. And like, enough, where at this point, enough people are listening that when Rick doesn't do that, he's going to look like a cheapskate. And Kim is like,
yeah.
Ugh. And like, they don't like linger on the point where like she knows he's about to go too far. She can feel it coming. And she like puts a hand on his arm, like, so gently, and he just jibbies it up. Like, he can't not. That's who he is. And she seems to realize in that moment, in the very cold car ride home, like, oh damn, like, this
and
is who.
I mean, you look at how much brown whiskey is in that glass, and you're, yeah, like, if we get out of this without someone booting in a plant, I will be happy. And then that we do get out of it without that, and I was still not happy. Like,
yes,
that car ride, she's like, well, that happened, you fucker. And he's like, I mean,
right.
Yeah.
And it's a great moment. Like, it certainly it pushes forward the plot for that season, but I still don't think this is the episode that pushes it. Like, this isn't the one that I would choose from this season to induct in the canon. And I also just want to say, just as a side note, the first time I ever heard the song Something Stupid that I can recall anyway being conscious of is in the Simpsons episode where Sideshow Bob marries Selma. And there's a montage in that one too where they're falling in love to Something Stupid. And then later when he's unfurling his plan, he sings, and then I go and spoil it all by doing something stupid like explode you, which is all I always think when I see this, hear that song or see this title still. So
the song is like just disgusting.
It's so creepy.
Disgusting.
Don't sing that with your dad. Don't sing it with your daughter. Gross.
Don't sing it.
Well,
did not win Record of the Year Grammy. Just
no. It's a very pretty song. It just sort of been people singing it
who could have made out.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead, Dave.
I don't have a ton to add. I think this is an episode with a few good, like, really good moments. Obviously, the opening is fantastic, really well directed. Where is that Deborah Chow when it came to Obi-Wan Kenobi? Because the the whole Hector, the whole, you know, Gus and the therapist scene where the fate of Hector is determined is fantastic. Really speaks to his character. I thought that was great. And of course, then the escalation of the business retreat is also great, but it doesn't really coalesce into something that feels like more than the sum of its parts, mm-hmm. which I think is like kind of what we're all saying in different ways, which
except
is
Alan.
Except Alan. I mean, us of the gang.
Yeah.
And wait, are you saying that I'm in the tank for like a Vince Gilligan universe show? Because that doesn't sound like me.
So like a lot of sort of like marginal yes, no votes. This is like a good episode, very watchable for me, but not quite elevated to like the creme de la creme for me. I think there are other episodes, certainly in this series, but perhaps also in this season that I could put above this. But let's make this official. Alan Breaking Bad Steppenwolf. What say you?
Yes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah, they didn't get D.B. Cooper. It's true. And this is not going to get in the canon from me. I know it's weird to vote no on an episode that is like objectively better television than probably 40% of the episodes that are in the canon, but yeah, that's not the criteria. So no, it's a no for me. Sorry.
That's the thing. There's always a higher, there's a higher bar to clear when it's a very good show. And for me, yeah, this one didn't get there. Although thank you so much, Laura, for the submission.
All right. I agree. So that means that Better Call Saul, Season 4, Episode 7, Something Stupid, very good episode, but not quite canon-worthy for a show of this caliber.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
All right, it's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Sarah has this week's winner.
Speaking of wonderful guest performances on Better Call Saul, Carol Burnett.
Hey!
90th birthday tribute at NBC. I am excited to watch that. Her guest starring choices over the last 10 or 15 years have been fascinating. She's fantastic and was a big part of my watching reruns in the afternoon childhood. And I'm excited to see what NBC comes up with. I hope it's the corn proportions are manageable.
And Loser of the Week, Tara?
Well, I'm gonna go over some headlines and then I'll give you the loser last. So headline one, Paramount Plus is absorbing Showtime. They are stupidly renaming themselves Paramount Plus with Showtime when Paramount Plus Showtime was right fucking there.
Yeah, but now we get to abbreviate it to P plus lowercase w slash capital S. So that's something.
Pews? Pew, pew, pews, pew, pews. Mm.
True. Nope. That decision has led to Let the Right One In and American Gigolo, or at least they were both announced at the same time. They are canceled after one season each. Three Women, which is a new show that Betty Gilpin was to have been in, has been shot. It's sitting in a can somewhere, and Showtime / Paramount Plus is like, nope, they're not going forward. They're going to try and shop it elsewhere. Also led to the removal of several Showtime shows from the platform, including Kidding, remember that? Happening yesterday as we're recording this, Hulu canceled Reboot after one season, and for that reason, Loser of the Week is Judy Greer, star of Reboot and Kidding. She deserves better. We are failing Judy Greer. Loser.
Truth. Always.
Speaking about things you fail, do you know what time it is?
It's Greer time.
All right, it's been a hot minute since we've been in regulation land. Remind you, this is the ninth game time of the season. The scores are Tara with 4, could clinch the season with a win today. Sarah with 0, unless something amazing happens. She's not going to clinch the win today. And value guess,
I have a lot of steel meals, people.
With it's 4. True. So if Tara or Alan wins today, the season will end.
Oh my.
Wait, so like I could get the Karate Kid song played for me? Oh, shit. Okay.
Today we are playing another round of 19 questions with the with help from the good people at EHG Assist on Twitter.
Oh boy.
To remind you how this works, you must guess the TV thing. Could be a show, character, object, catchphrase, that kind of thing that I have in my head by asking me yes, no questions. If you ask a question and get a yes answer, you get to ask again.
Okay.
If you get a no, then the next person in line then asks. First person to correctly identify the TV thing gets the point. Now, I have a number. We're going to kind of, it could go long, could go short. So we'll either play through the whole thing or we're going to play to time. I will be the arbiter of that. So okay. I can't give you an exact question count right now. No steel meals. No goes for the Equalizer Challenge Zones and 19 questions.
Yep.
Let's throw it to Pinky to see our order for the whole game.
Oh, God.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, going. Okay. Sarah, Tara, Alan for the whole game. Remember who you're after so that when there's a no answer, you're ready with your question. All right, this time we are going to go in blind. Nobody's going to know until everybody knows what they are. We're not going to do a password style where we put the name of it on the screen for you. So let's just get right into it.
Okay.
The category for the first TV thing is animal.
Animal.
Animal. Sarah, first.
Animal.
Yes.
Okay.
So ask me a question. I can answer with a yes or a no.
Gotcha. Was the animal the star of the show?
Good question.
Of its show.
It was not.
Okay. Is the animal a pet of a character on the show?
No.
Okay.
To Alan.
Is the animal animated?
No.
Do we see the animal?
Yes.
Ooh.
Was the animal on a network show?
No.
Was the animal on a show that is still on?
No.
Okay.
To Alan. Alan's thinking.
I'm thinking.
There's only so many animals on TV. Probably 20 max.
Is the animal in multiple episodes of the show?
No.
Was the animal on a late night talk show?
No.
Was the animal in a comedy?
No.
Does the animal wander into Tony Soprano's backyard?
I genuinely don't know, but I'm going to give you a yes on that just so you can continue answering because of the nature of the question.
All right. Is the animal a mammal?
Yes.
Oh.
Is the animal a bear?
No.
Ugh.
All right. So we've narrowed the field considerably after that.
Is the animal a duck?
Sorry, a what?
That's duck. Not a mammal.
Oh. Birds aren't mammals. Not a science major. Is the animal a reptile?
No, it's a mammal that has been established. Okay. Is
Sarah's Wikipediaing mammal right now.
is it
start writing this down.
Is the animal probably over 50 pounds?
Yes.
Is the animal probably over 100 pounds?
Yes.
Is the animal probably over 200 pounds?
Probably.
Is the animal not, while like, we've established it's not a bear, is it the size of a bear?
More or less, yeah.
Okay. Is this an animal that... Okay, it could have been in Tony Soprano's yard, so it could. This is an animal that does live in North America. Shit.
I don't think it was in its yard, but the problem is with 19 questions.
Okay.
I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of all of them, so I'm basing it off. So you have to put a maybe in that one.
Got it.
I just don't know what he's talking about.
Okay. Is it an ungulate, meaning does it have hooves? Okay.
Oh.
Is it a moose? Shit. Okay. But we know it has hooves.
Okay. It's been so long since we had to move the proceedings. It is to
Alan. It's me. Yeah.
Yes.
Is it a horse?
A one episode horse.
Is it Pi-O-Mai?
It is Pi-O-Mai. First point to Alan.
Great job.
Thank you to Shan for that item. Nicely done. I thought we'd start off with something that was very much in Alan and Sarah's wheelhouse. All right. The next one, we will start off with Sarah again, since Alan asked that one. The second type of TV thing is location. This is a location.
Is the location in the United States?
No.
Is the location on Earth?
Yes.
Okay. Is it in Europe?
Yes.
Okay. Is it in a mostly English-speaking country?
Yes.
Okay. Is it in England?
Yes.
Okay. Is it in London?
I'm gonna say no.
Okay.
To Alan.
I'm trying to think. British shows not taking place in London. Is it an indoor location?
I'll say yes.
Okay. Is it a place where people work?
I think I got it.
Yeah.
Is it a place in the present day when the show came out?
Yeah.
Is it an office?
It is not.
Sarah, I think you got this too.
I don't think so, because present day doesn't work. So it's not an office? Is that what we just
not an
correct.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just going to guess it anyway because I'm wondering what Tara thinks we were guessing. Is it Downton Abbey?
Okay.
Is it the tents from Great British Bake Off?
It is the Great British Bake Off tents.
There's buntings at both.
One to Alan, one to Tara. All right, our next item, and we'll start with Alan, is an object. This is a television object, an object in a television show.
An object. Where do we want to start with this? What the hell? Is the object animated?
Is the object animated?
Or is the object from an animated show?
Yes.
Okay. does the object appear in every episode?
Yep.
Is the object in someone's home?
To Sarah.
Is the object in an animated show on a broadcast network?
It is.
Is the object in The Simpsons?
It's not.
Is it from a network show that is still on?
Yes.
Okay. Ooh. Is it, it's an animated show. Is it in Bob's Burgers?
It is.
Okay. Oh, shit. Is it, there's so many things it could be. Is it something that's in the restaurant?
Yes.
Is it the ice cream maker? Shit.
No.
Okay.
Is it the slate where you write the burger of the day?
It is. It's the burger of the day sign. Nicely done.
Glad that
all
didn't
right.
get to me because I was just going to start guessing.
Is it the elephant
crap.
from the Edison musical episode?
In every episode. That was a really good question. All right. Mm-hmm. We're going to do another object. We'll be starting with Sarah since Alan got that one. TV object. Sarah. Oh, I'm sorry. Just let me rewind for a second. I want to say thank you for Great British Bake Off tent from Amelia.
Nice.
And object burger of the day sign was from Sheena. All right. Nice. Object, this one's from Kimberly.
Is this from a live action show? Not animated show.
Yes.
Is it from a competition show?
No.
Okay. Is the show still on?
Okay, Dave,
I'm going to give you guys a good clue. Not in that incarnation, but I believe technically it is still on.
Okay.
I'm going to let Tara ask another question.
Oh, okay.
It exists in two states, I suppose.
That is in limbo. Okay. From a network?
Yes.
Okay. Is it a drama?
No. All right, now to Alan.
Okay, just before I ask my actual question, yes. I have to apologize. My brain is not what it used to be. Mm-hmm. What is the category here? You
object.
Said it, and it,
we're another object.
Object.
It's another object. Yeah. Okay, yeah. It's another object. It's not on a drama. It's not on a competition show. So I'm gonna guess it's on a comedy. What the hell comedy is in limbo? Is it a show on NBC? Okay, it's a comedy in limbo on NBC.
Hasn't been established as a comedy. It could be something else.
Okay. Is it a comedy? Okay.
No.
It's going down the wrong path. Okay,
Sarah.
Is it smaller than a bread box?
Yes.
Is it usually found in a kitchen?
I feel like I need to triangulate on what the show is. It's so weird. Okay, it's not a drama. Is it a soap?
Okay. Is it a talk show?
Okay.
It is.
Oh, God. What? Okay. What
talk show in limbo.
I say it was in limbo.
Okay, okay.
Okay. All right, okay, okay. Does it appear often? Okay. An NBC talk show, a thing that appears often. Is it on Late Night with Seth Meyers?
Mm-hmm. Sarah. Lots of additional information there from Alan's questions.
But I don't watch talk shows, so not really. Is it a host desk item?
I'm gonna say yes on that.
Okay. Is it a mug?
Okay. It is a desk host desk item, so this is a show with a host. Is the host a man? Okay. Is the host?
Just out of interest. Is there a late night host on NBC that ever wasn't a man? I mean, just out of
Guess Amber Ruffin is on Peacock, not.
No. The show that was on after.
Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Lily, what's her face?
Right. Singh.
Lily Singh.
Lily Singh. Thank you.
All right. Anyways. Back.
Okay.
No stalling, Tara.
Yeah. All right.
That was all me. I don't know why I said that.
Is it a daytime show?
Okay, so we're basically down to two things here, but I'm trying to think of like desk items from either one of those. Is it from Saturday? No, it's not. That's a sketch show. Is it from The Tonight Show? Huh.
Is it note cards?
But that's not specific enough.
Yeah. Okay.
I think yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I
get it now.
Okay, I don't. Is it a top 10 list? This would be wrong, so sorry. Thank you.
Is it Letterman's note cards that he would throw through and make the glass shattering sound?
Letterman's blue index cards, yes.
Yep.
Thank you, Kimberly, for that one. All right, so that means we're all tied up again.
Yep.
2-2. Our next TV thing is a talent. Talent, a skill.
A talent?
Yeah, a talent or a skill demonstrated.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something different, something new.
Yeah. Yes.
And this comes from somebody, I forgot to write their name down. I apologize. Hit me for an extra credit, anonymous person, that I am not giving credit to.
Dave does not have the talent of good record keeping.
All right, so that is to Alan.
Is it a superhuman talent?
No.
Oh, okay.
Is it from a talent/competition show?
Good question. It is not.
Okay. Is it a talent that we see in more than one show?
Oh, I would say yes. It is not. Yeah. I've seen it done different places.
Okay. So it's not. Yeah. It's not tied to a specific.
Not a
show.
Singular talent.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Is it a talent that. So it's not superhuman. Is it a talent that regular people also do outside of a TV context? Okay. Is it something that someone in your life can do? That you know of?
Yeah, I remember somebody doing it. I don't know if they're like, but I'm gonna say like.
Okay.
It's common enough that I have known somebody who has done it. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Is it like? Is it a kind of a magic trick?
Kind of a magic trick. No.
Is it okay? Not a magic trick. Okay.
I was thinking magic trick. So yeah. Okay. Does it involve playing cards?
No.
Okay. All right.
Does it involve music?
It's not.
Huh.
Fuck, this is complicated.
This is one of the tougher ones.
Yeah.
It's not this... the toughest one. The toughest one is next.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Oh, God.
Is it...
I might skip the next one for time.
Okay.
I would
Thank
love
you,
to
Dave.
Is it an impression?
No.
Okay.
Okay. You said it was... It's been featured on multiple shows, but is it specifically associated or primarily associated with one show?
No.
That's a good question.
Oh, sorry. Oh. No.
No? Okay.
Sorry. Bad
Fake
day.
Out.
It is not.
Is it primarily associated with one job?
With one job. Can you give me an example so I can wrap my head around it?
Like lawyers, doctors.
Oh, I see. Is it a job-based skill kind of?
Yes.
It is not.
Is it something that you need tools or props to do?
No.
Okay.
Is it something that someone does on a current television show?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Is it smizing?
Oh my God, that's such a good guess. That is such a good
Couldn't
guess.
Couldn't get it out of my head. I had to do it.
From a competition show.
One Tara point.
Congratulations.
Yes, not a, it's redeemable for love. Oh God. Ooh. Is it like a kind of a dance?
Is it a kind of a dance? No.
Okay.
Is it in any way musical?
That was already asked.
Yeah, it was already asked.
Okay, sorry. Okay, all right. So the kind of a dance. Let's see here. Is it when it appeared on television, because it's not on a current show, mm-hmm. were those shows in black and white?
Ooh. No.
Okay.
Okay.
Does it involve the face?
Yes.
Okay. 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 That's good.
Is it tying a cherry stem in a knot with your tongue?
Ooh.
It is. But we're looking for the person who does this.
Oh.
Okay.
It's that person's talent, but I need you to connect the talent with the character as an answer.
Oh.
I mean, I feel like I've seen it done a gazillion times, so don't know.
Come on, Sarah, you got this.
Connected to, is it Benson?
She didn't watch the show.
Tara.
It's Audrey Horn from Twin Peaks.
It's Audrey Horn from Twin Peaks.
Yeah, I didn't watch
that show. Tying the cherry. With her tongue.
Later attempted by Rachel Green, who then choked on it and had to be...
Which, you know, Twin Peaks nerd trivia, Sherilyn Fenn actually couldn't do it, but Maid Kanamek could.
She had a tongue double?
Yeah, I bet she could.
Yeah.
That's my girl.
All right. I will skip this really hard one.
Can you tell us what it is? Oh, you're going to save it?
I'll save it just in case.
For when we were bad? Yeah, great.
So the next one. So it's 3 to Tara.
Yep.
2 to Alan.
Correct.
Our next item is simply a show.
Oh.
It is a show. So
okay.
Alan gets first crack at the show.
All right. Is it a current show?
It is not.
Ugh.
I liked Alan's narrowing this down. So was it a black and white show?
Oops. No, it wasn't.
Is it from the 2010s?
Is it from the 20th century?
Is it from the 20th century? It is indeed from the 20th century.
Okay, but that hesitation makes it seem like it straddles two centuries.
Yes, it does.
No.
Right? So
No.
Does not?
Okay.
I'm not saying it does or not, but I was just like, okay. I was multitasking. I'm going to be honest with you. I was doing.
Got it.
I was looking something up to make sure I had the answer at the ready in case somebody asked.
Okay,
fair enough.
Non-probative pause.
Okay.
Got it.
So it's a 20th century show. Is it a scripted television show?
It is.
Is it a comedy?
No.
So it's definitely not Benson. Is it? Is it a cop show?
To your knowledge, do I or did I watch this show?
That narrows it down.
I don't think we have ever watched this together.
Okay.
Okay.
That is relationship question privilege, by the way.
Yes. That seems like a home field advantage.
Yeah, that is. Yeah.
You know?
Only if it worked. It didn't. So. Okay.
Was it an award-winning show?
Okay.
No hesitation.
This show is dog shit.
I mean, I'm sure somebody gave it an award for something, but you
sure.
know, it's not.
Okay.
to Vazzy.
Yeah.
Was it a kids show? Or like a...
Okay. No.
Okay. We haven't established, is it a drama?
Yeah. Whoops. I mean, yes.
Okay.
Okay. Was it a network drama? Okay. Was it on NBC?
I was going to double check. I believe it was.
Okay. Ooh. In the 90s? Okay.
Okay, it's not a cop show, but is there a mystery component to the show?
No.
Okay.
Not a mystery show.
Okay.
All right.
Was it Hill Street Blues?
Oh, that's cop show.
Not a cop show.
Well, now we know.
Oh, boy. Okay.
And an award winner, too.
Okay.
Should I
not a mystery. I mean, I want, since you brought it up now, I wonder if this is why it
I'm
was
not
on
saying there's not questions asked during the show, but it's not like a Murder, She Wrote
Got it.
Kind of thing.
Is it Highway to Heaven? It seemed like such a random reference. I thought it must have been in your mind for a reason. Okay.
All right. Is it from the 1970s?
Okay.
It is.
All right. I could ask a bunch, but I feel like it's the Rockford Files. Is it the Rockford Files?
Mm.
Ah. No. Okay. Too soon.
This is from Giovanni, if that helps you guys. Giovanni gave us this one.
Bene. I don't remember what was on which network back then. Was it Starsky and Hutch? I think that was ABC, but anyway.
And a cop show.
I don't know what things are.
Oh,
it's a mammal. Starsky and Hutch were mammals.
The duck. Shut up.
Okay.
Starsky and ducks.
Fuck. I don't know what. Okay. Was it like, was it a primetime soap? Okay.
Was it, did it involve teenagers? Okay.
Not in a meaningful way. I'm sure there were teenagers
sure.
on it.
Okay. All right.
My mind has emptied of shows. Of all kinds. Was it a bike? I don't know what's happening. I literally cannot think of a show that is not like a mystery component or cops involved. Oh, God.
I was going to say, just because, you know, when I play, I'm very methodical about these things. There's lots of ways to attack it. Nail down the genre. You could ask questions about what letter it starts with. You can ask about, you know, the subject matter.
Okay.
You know, you can attack in different
ways. All right.
All
right. Okay.
Was it a, medical show?
No. Okay.
Okay. Does it start with a letter in the first half of the alphabet? Okay.
Okay. All right. So it's not Baa Baa Black Sheep, which was obviously going to be my next guess. Was the star of the show someone who has starred in multiple shows?
Ooh. That's a good question.
That is a good question. I'm going to look that up.
Sounds like
he's
no.
Gotta, he's got to look that
gotta
up.
Got to look it right, up. That's a good hint. It's a good hint.
Telling me something. All right. 1970s NBC show.
All right. What was the question again?
Did the person who was the star of the show, have they starred in other shows?
Okay.
Oh, right. Okay.
Singular star.
Not a cop show, not a doctor show, doesn't involve teenagers, so that takes out the family shows. Is it a lawyer show?
No, you don't get to ask again. That was a no. It's Sarah's turn.
Enough. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Damn it. I don't understand.
Freebie for everybody out there. It's not a lawyer show.
Okay.
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 I will say, given all the questions and the low yield answers when it comes to people we know and stuff like that, that should be moving you towards a certain type of show.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is to say, not very popular.
Okay.
All right, Sarah.
Well, we know it's not The Secret Diary of Desmond Pfeiffer, because that was a duck and a cop show. What was I just going to ask?
Was the star
Stars and Nova
star alive?
Probably not.
Still? Okay.
Okay. So, okay. Is it
He died in 85.
Okay.
Wow.
He
Well, this is just like he's top billed. I'm not saying okay, he's the star of the show, but
yeah,
that's all I can give you.
Okay, is it like an adventure thriller type of show? Okay.
Oh.
Is it the $6 million man? Okay.
All right. Okay.
We know it's not that shitty show Dave made us watch for the Patreon where William Shatner is in Barbary Coast. Is that what that was called?
Barbary
we know
Coast.
It's not that.
What do you mean shitty show? That was thoroughly enjoyable.
That great show Dave made
and
us watch.
And a little bit racist.
he's alive Coast. And was in many shows.
Okay, but no, but Tara, you put me on a good path.
But
here,
I gotta say, the Barbary Coast is the best guess about this show yet.
Okay, yes.
Okay. Is it a show that you would expect all of us to have heard of?
Great question.
Yes.
Okay, we've heard of it.
Yes. Okay, all right. So it's not, NBC shows.
It's not Greatest American Hero because he was in other shows.
And that was ABC
was
in the 1980s.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Did it involve superpowers in some way? Okay.
Did it involve space?
was it a period show? Okay.
Well, no.
Okay, it was contemporary to the time it aired.
It tried to be.
Ish. Yeah. Okay.
Did it primarily take place outdoors?
Yeah, I'll give you a yes and a no on that one, but you continue.
Okay, all right. So it had notable outdoor stuff, but did not necessarily take place.
When you find out the answer, you'd be like, oh, okay, I see.
Okay.
God damn it. Was an animal prominently involved?
That's what I was thinking, too. So it's not BJ and the Bear.
And it's not Grizzly Adams. Okay.
And it was
All right, I'm going to give you guys a hint.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll take it.
God. Ask about the longevity of this show.
Okay.
Ooh, okay.
Or I'll just say it. This is a one-season wonder.
Okay.
But we've heard of this one season.
Absolutely.
Okay. Huh.
So it's not the Brady Bunch variety.
Nope.
Okay. So when you say it's mostly outdoors, is it a show that revolves around like driving? Like someone's often in a car or a truck. Okay.
Okay.
I paused there for a second.
He did. He did pause.
Waiting for you to clarify.
So there is some driving in it.
Or flying, perhaps. I'm trying to get us all there.
It's now turned into a group effort.
It's always kind of been a group effort.
Dave, is this Super Train?
Boom! Super Train!
Oh, Alan, thank God.
Oh. Nice work, Alan.
Hey, Tara, you helped get me there.
I don't think I ever knew that. I thought it was like a TV movie or a miniseries.
Yeah,
no, that's Fred Silverman like saved CBS. He saved ABC, and then he went to NBC and he created Super Train.
Not to be confused, Tara, with Atomic Train.
Thank you. Yeah. Starring our friend Rob Lowe. Yes.
the newly minted anti-Nazi FBI agent.
Yes.
All right, so that means it's 3-3, right?
It does.
This is the last category. This is it.
Oh, my God.
All right. All the more.
It is a TV object.
Okay, object.
Okay.
And Sarah goes first.
Yep.
And this is something you all know.
All right.
All the marbles.
Something we all know.
Yep.
Okay.
You all have a very good chance of getting this.
Okay, great.
Is it from an animated show?
It is not, but it is from Eric.
Oh, our friend Eric of Eric's
Meal. Of Eric's Meal.
Of Eric's Meal. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is it from a currently airing show?
Is it bigger than a bread box?
No.
Yeah.
Is it in the credits of whatever show it's in?
No.
Is it a not current show, but is it from this century?
Yes, it is from this century. Sorry.
It's from the 2000s.
Yes.
Okay. Is it from the 2010s? Okay. So it's from the 2000s.
It's from the 2000s. Is it from a scripted show?
Yes.
Okay. Is it from a comedy?
No.
Ah.
Not a comedy.
Okay.
Is it from a drama?
It is.
Is this drama on a network? Was it?
No.
Okay. A 2000s show, so it's probably cable because there was not really streaming then, but I feel like I shouldn't rule it out. Oh my god. Okay, was it from a cable channel? Was it from cable? Okay. Was it premium cable?
Preem.
Okay. I'm taking notes. I'm taking cuckoo
time is,
notes.
Time is
here.
Precious. Is
yes, it is.
Is it Preem Ka?
Okay, is it from HBO? Okay.
All right, okay.
Oh, from the 2000s, an object. Oh, my God. Was it from... It's probably not from Sopranos, because he's already done that. Was it from 6 Feet Under?
Okay. Is it from The Wire?
Oh!
Okay, what's a wire object? Damn it.
I have a guess.
Is it Fuzzy Dunlop?
That was my guess! Damn it!
Wait, we established that it's larger than a bread box, right?
No,
it's smaller than a bread
box. Smaller than a bread box. Okay, so that rules out the couch. smaller than a bread box.
Sarah, if you get this, I have to use that really tough one as a tiebreaker.
No! Okay.
No, Sarah, still try and get it.
Yeah, is it a pager?
That's a good one. Is it Lester's dollhouse furniture?
It is Lester's dollhouse furniture.
Oh. Tara.
Tara's real 19 questions police.
Hold on, wait.
Yes, Mr. Steppenwall.
I mean, I've got to be pedantic here. If it's dollhouse furniture, how do we not know that there was a dollhouse-sized bread box, in which case the rest of the furniture was larger than that?
Dang. All right, I guess we got to play this hard one then.
No!
Oh, God.
This is a TV show that never aired. TV show that never aired.
No, we don't really have to do this.
The answer was hieroglyph. The answer was hieroglyph. Look at that. Tara is wearing her strike first, strike hard, no mercy. I pitched her a shirt idea last week, which was this. Strike first, strike hard, no mercy, ... pick two.
I think that's great.
And I thought that was the funniest shit I've ever heard in my life.
I
love me, says Dave. Well, congratulations, Tara. Well fought, Alan. Nicely done, Sarah. That is it for this episode of Extra Hot Great. We took the weird things stuck up our asses out long enough to discuss the throwback mystery show Poker Face before going around the dial with stops at Married at First Sight, Shrinking, Russian Doll, Lockwood & Company, and 911 Lone Star. Jeff explained why he is not a crackpot for poo-pooing bottle episodes, while Laura unsuccessfully made the case for Better Call Saul's Something Stupid. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from @EHGAssist. Next up, Latter-day Subways on Extra, Extra Hot Great, and right here on the next EHG Prime is Dear Edward with Mark Blankenship. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana,
explode you,
Sarah D. Bunting,
avenge you, I don't even like you,
and Alan Steppenwall,
bullshit.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Bigger Than a Bread Box.
Is it a duck?
All right, RV leaves Monday. I'll send you the deets. Gavin, we're all in our 40s. Let's take a fucking bath.
Take a bath.
I'm not joking.
Okay.